Excellent. So welcome to another enthralling entry into our webinar series. Are you ready for a breach is the question, and hopefully we can answer that for you, or at least help you get into a position where you can answer that. Breach readiness and incident response are definitely critical capabilities. We've seen in a whole host of impactful breaches recently. They all seem to be in the UK. I'm sure there are plenty of others. That preparedness is absolutely key. Key to responding to that threat, key to protecting data and our customers, key to our brand, and also key to keeping businesses ongoing and business as usual. And there are many different elements to this. And answering that, I'm going to pick the brains of a true expert in the field, Patrick Ragg. So I'm joined by Patrick today, and Patrick is our head of incident response at Integrity 360. He has a pretty long and illustrious career of heading up incident response teams and overseeing engagements across EMEA, across America, across Asia-Pac, and I'm sure beyond, wherever that might be. But also supporting, well over 1,500 employees in-house within one organization. He has a whole host of, or he's had a whole host of roles in cybersecurity, including, incident response, clearly, but also advising on managed detection and response services and detection engineering. So really playing into his strengths as an incident responder. He holds a degree in computer forensics. His thesis was on a PDF analysis tool to break redaction, which was featured in multiple cyber publications. And generally, he's an all-round legend when it comes to incident response. As many know, I tend to steal his greatest stories and make out that they're my own when presenting. So welcome, Patrick.
Cheers, Rich. How you doing?
Thanks for joining us for this webinar today. Today we are delivering this in my favorite format, which is the fireside chat. So no slides today, just pure insights that we're going to pull out of Patrick. But before we kick off, I just want to make everyone aware of the Q&A function. You should have that at the bottom of your Zoom window there. So please ask any questions, anything that we're touching upon, or anything questions around incident response, breach readiness, into that Q&A function, and we will answer those at the very end of this session. And we're also going to be launching some polls, make this interactive. We're keen to get your insights and views, particularly as we can then crowdsource some of this some information that we can all then dive down into. So with that, let's actually kick off with a poll. So, Rebecca, if you can, our first poll is, how confident are you in being able to detect a breach? So really, that's probably the starting point. And I suppose we're not talking about threat detection here. We're actually talking about, a breach has happened. How quickly and how confidently are we that that within 24 hours we'll detect that breach?
Just noticed I can't vote on that.
That's right. No voting rights for panelists.
No.
I will let you tell everybody your answer, which I hope is very confident.
I'm just thinking about it, actually.
Okay, brilliant. So I think we had a good number of results in there. So Rebecca, if you want to just end that poll, and we can kind of look at the results and share those results, which I got a couple of people on the webinar are very confident, which is great to see. But most and the majority, in fact, actually an even split there between being somewhat confident and not confident. And a few that are in that unsure, which is probably a position we want to look at moving out of, being, getting to the point where we're sure of our capability, whether that's us being confident or somewhat confident, or very confident, but at least we can then build the strategy and roadmap until we get there. So that's and that's probably very common, reflects very commonly what we see. And Patrick, I guess from what I see, but from your perspective, any kind of views there on what you guys see?
I mean, in terms of confidence, it's definitely, I think we actually see more on the more confident side. And then the worst incidents come from when customers are overconfident, or they're just playing ignorance, basically. They think that they've got coverage. But I'd say the better incidents that we deal with are the customers that are much more modest, much more modest. So
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay, excellent. So, so that's enough for myself. Let's bring very Patrick straight into the conversation. And I think a good place us to start when we're looking at incident response incidents, how we respond to them, and how we can avoid the impact of those breaches. So, starting down that path really of breach readiness, is to look at Patrick. Let's set the scene. What are the common pitfalls? And I suppose pitfalls, what have you seen in terms of, incident response fails, should I say?
Yeah. So that definitely fails. I mean, I've done a fair amount of incidents in my career, and some of the following are fails that I've dealt with. Others are plucked from, the public, public incidents that have happened, and it just so happens that the information for that incident gets out there. I'm not going to tell you which companies each one is, because then, it might be a little bit too giving stuff away. I'll just start with actually a more recent one, which is the CrowdStrike one, which is public knowledge, so it's okay to say. But basically, an engineer is allegedly paid around $30,000 to send screenshots of the inner workings of CrowdStrike. That's an interesting one, a clear case of insider abuse, and the lengths of the lengths that attackers are going to take to, spend good money, a large amount of money, to try and get access. I personally think they should have paid more. 30K is not enough for
You wouldn't
that.
sell us out for 30K, is that what you're telling me?
No, I wouldn't. It had to be double that, I
Good.
think, at least. Another one is an outsourced service desk, so an outsourced service desk company, so an IT management company, that fell for a social engineering attack, which, in my opinion, they are pretty much designed to protect that company against. They fell for it, and a fake employee rang up pretending to be, an admin, and then got their credentials changed. That one was a major incident that we all know about in the UK a few months back. Another one that we've dealt with is where remote help software was being used for a customer who was using remote help software to manage a large amount of their other customers. So this was like a managed service provider. That remote help software got breached through an unpatched version, and then the attacker then got access to all of that customer's customers. So if you get what I mean, there was about 200 or 300 customers that got compromised.
I think, when we've talked to this, very common. I suppose we'll come on to what you guys have seen responding to, but far too much, or too many times, should I say, that organizations have been breached through unpatched, very patchable. So it's not like it's a zero day, but unpatched software, unpatched applications, and operating systems that can be exploited. Which, I'm sure most people are probably sick of me banging on about, the basics of cyber security and hygiene. But I suppose that kind of echoes the need to have a very good view of all your assets, what's in the network, what applications you've got, and what state they're in. That it talks to, we're probably still not getting that 100% right.
No, I mean, I worked for a company. This was about 6 or 7 years back, and they had a big data center. And there was a cupboard in the room, which everyone said, "Right, don't go near that cupboard, because you don't want to know what's inside it." And I did happen to see it one day, and it was literally covered in cobwebs. It was an old voice over IP system that was connected to the internet, completely exposed. And I think it was like from 1985 or something. It was still there, and it was still plugged in. And basically, you weren't allowed to mention it. So,
Yeah, maybe 1995. I think there wasn't much VoIP around in the 80s, but so a fair while back. But very uncommon. So I suppose there's some of the things that have led to those breaches. I think, Patrick, if we kind of carry on that train of thought, and particularly in terms of IR fails. What are the things that you've seen that perhaps shouldn't, but there's probably a better way of doing it, or as organizations have come and started in terms of actually, their immediate response to an incident?
I think the best things to do to prepare before an incident escalates is maintain an IR plan. So there's loads of different words for this. So it could be a playbook, could be an IR run book, could be a plan, could be a policy. But basically having that there and having one tailored to your organization is absolute key. I mean, if you don't, it's essentially like running in the dark. You just don't know where you're going, you don't know what you're doing. There are other things as well. You mentioned asset inventory earlier as well. So covering off exactly what you've got in your organization, that's super important, because like you said, you don't want that dusty box in the corner to allow access to, someone getting in. Risk assessments, so perform frequent risk assessments. So look at your infrastructure and think to yourself, what is the riskiest part of this business? If you've got a lot of externally facing assets like servers or systems, maybe they're the most vulnerable, maybe they're the most riskiest. Whereas if you've got a lot of, I don't know, consumer data that you allow them to log in through a portal, maybe that portal's going to be the easily attacked region. Perform regular risk assessments. Obviously, it goes without saying, but 24/7 alert monitoring, because attackers don't follow 9 to 5. The majority of the breaches that we deal with are actually around the Christmas period. So I remember last year I got one on New Year's Eve, which was fun. And then regular training and tabletops are really, 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 really useful. And not just from a tabletop point of view. Not just your typical high level tabletop where it's like your management, you get a management involved in C-suite and you talk about business continuity. No, I'm talking low level technical tabletops where basically incident simulations, where they like test the people on the ground so that, the tools, the forensics, like what to do, first responder, basically activity. I mean, I was telling a customer actually this morning. A customer this morning that an example of that a good example of a testing your SOC, testing your 24/7 monitoring, as in through a technical simulation, is just throw some software out there like PS Exec or something like that, which is a legitimate Microsoft tool. So I will say that it's not malware, legitimate Microsoft tool, but it does fire up a load of alarms and it is used by threat actors. Just install that on a box that's being monitored by your SOC and just see if they pick it up. It's a nice little test that when I was in a previous company, I used to do it once every few months. So just to see if they were watching. And then finally, backups are the most important thing to get ready, basically, to have the most important thing in a ransomware attack, which are really common these days. And just having a backup and recovery strategy and then testing it is so key these days. So.
Yeah, no, brilliant. We've probably jumped straight into there a little bit, but I think you talked about that preparedness being, simulation and testing. Rebecca, I think it's probably a good time for another poll. Actually, I'm going to jump into poll three, if that's okay, on your list there to launch, which is really to understand, has your organization conducted a breach simulation or tabletop exercise in the last 12 months? I think we can take that as, those tabletop exercises. We can talk about actually the breach simulation, similar to what Patrick was saying in terms of dropping PS Exec on to look at actually is our monitoring where it needs to be. I think they're actually, two sides of the coin in terms of are we ready? I think there's, or IR, we ready, is the ability to detect, is our, and that preparedness, is our detection capability, where it needs to be. Can we spot the activity that can lead us to that breach and get in there as soon as possible? But most importantly, are we in a position to respond quickly and efficiently. And we'll come on to that in a little bit, I suppose, what that really means. But good to get everyone's insight. So, Rebecca, we call that off or close off that poll now, and we can just have a quick look at the results. And it's good to see that 30% of people there are running it multiple times. I think that's critically important. What is what is the point of doing it multiple times? Well, things change, people change, the environment changes, what's critical to the business changes, and also it needs to be in the forefront of people's minds. Doing it a once off, although it's a good step, needs to be repeatable. And we see that there's a few people that haven't run them that are planning to. I would very strongly suggest doing that. And I think, Patrick, when we've talked about it before, running a tabletop exercise, there are definitely, I just talked about two sides of the coin in terms of the ability to detect and testing that breach simulation. But even the tabletop exercises, I think we're both, and tell me if I'm wrong, and I'm talking for you, but we're both big advocates of breaking that up into, a two-stage process. Testing the technical teams and their response. How do they respond? So the real technical incident response, which tells you actually here's an incident, here's how it plays out, and here's the information that they should be communicating up. And then the next part is to use that to then run that with the exec teams, so that we can see actually how would that play out? How would they respond to it? Because it goes so much further than just a technical incident response. Now, feel free to correct me if you think otherwise, Patrick. But I did just see in the Q&A we've got some corrections in place, or at least one correction there for the CrowdStrike thing. I think someone's saying it was 30K per screenshot, so maybe it's worth taking a few
Lovely.
screenshots. And the other one was just someone anonymous for obvious reasons. I think this is in relation to that well-known breach that we're talking about, and actually multiple breaches involving TCS. And yeah, there is a root cause there's a route to TCS in these, but I don't think that's pretty much public knowledge that we can talk about. And also, sorry, and Ian again has called out the role of immutable backups, as part of your strategy, has to be key for responding to ransomware, as the backups are the first things that are targeted. We're gonna have a whole discussion around backups, and then being able to and actually, Patrick, the role of incident response in being able to understand the root cause, to understand how far back do we need to go in backups, to ensure that whatever we're recovering, isn't already compromised.
So and backups, immutable backups are so useful in more than just recovery. They're also, like you said, they're useful in the forensics. So if you've got, if the live environment has been destroyed, then yeah, you can recover from old backups, but you can also use those old backups, especially if you've got them at different snapshots and different days, or different, even different hours, but different days, different weeks. You can then put a picture together, a story of how that breach happened. So they're really useful, not just for recovery, but for the forensic piece as well. So.
Yeah, no, indeed. So I was going to spend some time talking about, we talked about some of those breaches, and we've obviously got Scattered Spider, Shiny Hunter, Lapsus, which all make up part of the comms, so that community, that loose collective. But I won't spend loads of time on that actually, because we'll quickly run out of time. There's plenty to get through. But Patrick, you were just reminding me earlier that that this community of hackers that formed the, what is it, Scattered, Lapsus, Shiny, has announced that they are disbanding, and no longer carrying out malicious attacks. Well, I think we'll see. I think that's a bit of a false flag there, to cover their tracks, or to at least take a little bit of heat off them.
No, I agree.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what,
No,
we'll park that there for a second, because I think we'll go off on down a bit of a rabbit warren there, talking about them. But obviously, if anybody wants to have a chat about those separately, for some more insights, then obviously ping us, and we can speak about that separately. So let's move on to, we talked about, or I say we, you talked about the the position that we need to get to, which is really being ready, and how do we go through, and what is the preparedness exercise that we need to go through. But let's talk about what is critical for an IR team. And obviously we get IR teams like your own. We've got IR teams that stood up in organizations, hybrid of the two as well. But if you're building an incident response team, or you're looking at how you should what you should be looking for in an incident response team, what are the critical capabilities, Patrick?
So for me, what makes a good incident response team or the good management of an incident is having a major incident manager. So that is basically someone who is capable of managing all aspects of the incident. So I kind of call them a kind of a glorified project manager, but in reality, it's much more than that. So they are capable of managing basically the stakeholders. So you'll have senior stakeholders, you'll have less stakeholders. So you'll have an IT manager, you'll have a lead service desk lead, you'll have a IT director, you might have a then you might have a C a CIO, CISO, CTO, and then even higher up than that to shareholders and exec as well, what's it called, C-suite kind of level people. And that person needs to be responsible for controlling all of the communications between these different levels. So that's one thing. The second thing is maintaining a war room. So a good incident is dictated by a good war room and good war room etiquette as well. So I actually teach a like a not class but like training on war room etiquette for some of our customers during their onboarding workshops. And that's things like not putting major updates in or not putting minor updates in the major war room, because usually you'll have breakout rooms with different technical breakout rooms, and then you have a major one. Making sure to make sure that something is true before you state it. Just all the way down to the low level, like what you should actually say when you're making an announcement in a war room, how you should do decision gates as well. So all that's kind of covered in war room etiquette, and having a good war room is really, really important. Then the other critical capabilities are, I think it's a pretty obvious one, but being able to do root cause analysis, so finding out how the bad guy got in, how the threat actor got in. You have to be able to do digital forensics at scale. You can't just kind of limit yourself to a few machines. I know in the old school days, I used to take around a write blocker with me and take a hard drive off a machine, run it, do an open image on it, take a hard drive, and then do machines one by one. And that was okay back then because hard drives were very, very small. But these days you're talking, 400 or 500 gig per drive, plus you've got things in the cloud now. So that's just not, it's just not capable. So you need to be able to do forensics at scale and with speed. So you need some sort of tool or script that can pull back stuff.
And
You got
that's,
me.
I think that's just before you go on to explain that, I think that's important. In fact, actually, only this morning I was talking with some colleagues, and that root cause analysis is important. I mean, many organizations have invested in managed detection and response services that are brilliant, that they're delivering that initial response, but really not every single one is going to it's going to be in the field of view and field of vision that they have. Being able to go to that full digital forensic scale at digital forensics at scale to be able to pull that root cause analysis. So it's not enough just to have an R and MDR. I think it's important that that we look at making sure that we've got incident response embedded as part of that for a full response, particularly when we're in the position of having a breach.
Yeah, and if you don't quite have an internal incident response team, the next best thing you can do for digital forensics at scale is have the logs there ready for when an incident response team does come in. When customers say, "How do we get all the good logs, all the good telemetry?" And an example of that is obviously on the paid side, you've got most good EDRs will have good telemetry, but On the free side, you could just roll out Sysmon on a Windows estate. It's free and it's dead easy to roll out. And
Well, do you
that
know what?
is
Not only
like,
that, Patrick, going forward, they're wrapping it into Windows 11 as a feature. So
ah.
I don't think it's default. I think you need to install it, but it's there to be enabled. So I think people should make use of that to be able to collect all that data, store it in the Windows event file, and then obviously farm it off to somewhere for long-term storage.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, other things that other critical capabilities are the having good playbooks or good runbooks for the containment and eradication side. So being able to contain an attacker is very important in a way that doesn't kind of push the boat down the road, push the boat down the water. It doesn't you're not playing whack-a-mole basically. We know in the some of the big breaches over the last sort of 6 months, from the retailers that a lot of whack-a-mole took place. So as the threat actor was found, they kind of contained that particular area, and then they realized, oh, the attacker's in another area as well. So it was kind of whack-a-mole trying to follow the breadcrumbs of that attacker. So
But
having a
just
good
going into that, Patrick, how do you how would you approach successful eradication?
So what we do is we the, obviously the most surefire way that you'll get every c cover every corner, unturn every stone is to get a full coverage. So do full forensics of the whole environment. We understand that that is not always possible, because by the time that my team's been called, the breach is already well underway. It's a matter of time, and it will take a long time to it potentially could take a long time to get full coverage of the client's estate. So what we do is we follow a kind of a breadcrumbs approach. So we'll find the initial indicators of where the attacker got in. We'll be able to find that or the initial kind of indicators that the customer's given us. So let's pick an example, like they've seen a user, an admin user downloading a database or something. So we would follow the logs from that user. We would follow them all the way back, follow the breadcrumbs as to where they've been, have they jumped from this box to this box, and so on, until we get a full picture of where they've been. And then we would look to eradicate like that, basically. So we'd looked, we either create a script or some sort of, EDR rule or firewall or a combination of all three and get rid of them in one go. But we would never just contain devices as we go. You have to get a full picture of what's happened. And sometimes, I mean, this is the case with what happened with Co-op. Co-op realized that they didn't want to go through, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of forensics. They just shut everything off. So that's the kind of nuclear option. And we would never do that by default, but sometimes you do have to make that decision to do that, especially where you don't really know, where they are. So.
And we'll come on to it in a second, but I think that's an important part of pre preparedness, being able to get to that point where you can make a decision, because that's not a security decision. That is major business impact, but everything's got to fit together. So sorry, I jumped in there on critical capabilities. I don't know if you had any other to cover off.
Just yeah, like you said, with the ha having it's a business decision, isn't it? But from the recovery point of view, we would normally, when we write recovery plans for customers during incidents, we would focus on the critical systems first. So get the critical, payroll, ERP, stuff like that up and running straight away, and then a good IR team will produce a formal IR report, basically, and with recommendations as well. And a very good IR team will actually hold your hand through those recommendations, through the coming 6 months or so to actually get them implemented.
Yeah, well, talking of a good IR team, I think you've got a pretty great IR team that you've assembled, Patrick, to help our customers in the time of need. But when you're looking at evaluating an IR team, what are the common pitfalls to avoid, or what are the good things? What does good look like? What should people be evaluating on?
So with IR, incident response retainers or incident response services, 90% of it is in the preparation. It's all about the onboarding, and that's one of the main benefits of the service, is that you get together with a customer beforehand and you find out exactly what infrastructure they got, what systems, what are their processes, who are their people. You hash everything out before they have an incident, because you know not every customer will have an incident. And people always tell me in calls, hope we don't have to call you, or hope we don't see you again, basically, after our calls. But yeah, so it's yeah, good preparation is absolutely key. So for example, we do a lot of info sharing, where we'll sit down with a customer and we'll get a lot of information back and forth. We make it a discussion. But one of the other good things that we do is we do tabletops, like basically mini kind of scenario tabletops, with the customer. And we act out an incident as if they are using us. So it's almost like a, it's almost at the end of them, it feels like we're both part of the same organization, so that when they do have a breach, you know, we're ready to go. So that's, so yeah, preparation is absolute key for retainers. The obvious one after that would be fast response and on-site capabilities. I'd say, unless you've got a, I say most companies have cloud and and aren't on-prem, but the majority of the time that you need someone on site is more for the incident manager role. So it's to have someone from your provider, your IR provider, there in the war room physically to speak face to face and, you know, give assurances and generally just manage the incident. It's a bit difficult to do that remotely when it's a big incident. It's better to do it in person.
And well, and also let's not forget about utilities, manufacturing, and OT response, which I know is we're kind of go off on a bit of a tangent there, and I think we'll have a follow-up webinar to talk around OT, incident response, in the future, because I think it's critically important for people in those sectors. But yeah, having the ability to get on site in a pretty quick time is invaluable.
And so just some final ones there as well. Tool or environment agnosticism. So what that means is, the IR team should be able to just be able to deal with any device you've got, regardless of the operating system, regardless of what's running on it. I mean, even if it's like, you know, Windows XP or even further back than that, they should be able to do their job on that. So because we've got customers ranging all sorts, you know, from bus manufacturing companies to hospitals, you know, it's they're totally different infrastructures. So you need to be able to run the tools on everything. And then finally, the ability to bring in people from different cyber disciplines as part of the engagement. So, you know, if we need a you need a GRC person, a consultant in GDPR, or you need a firewall engineer, they should be able to just bring them in, like, and not, you know, you shouldn't have to add any commercials or any of that. It should just be seamless. Basically, you just bring them in as an extra resource. So.
Yeah, so very, very much holistic response capabilities that that we need to look for. Now, you mentioned and you touched upon some of those pieces around decision making, and you thought about communication in the war room. But I think incident response is a part of if someone has an incident. If you look at some of those major breaches. That's not just an incident, that is a crisis for the organization, for their customers, for their suppliers, in the case of Jaguar Land Rover, in their supply chain they're delivering into, in the case of Co-op Group. So this entire crisis and fits into crisis management. Where does incident response fit into that? And I suppose we can touch about what we see as crisis management overall.
I think so. Cyber and IT, a lot of businesses, especially non-technical ones, they think of IT as like a, you know, a tiny little piece, but in reality, IT and cyber basically are a huge play a huge part in organizations. So there's many different integration points where the, you know, the cyber or the cyber response will make a difference to the business continuity as well. So you know, the overall crisis management. So those are, you know, government and decision making. Sorry, governance and decision making. It should go hand in hand. So, like I said earlier, with the major incident manager, it's a, to make a major cyber decision could also mean making a major business decision as well. Another one would be communications and PR as well. So another integration point, communications and PR. Comms, you need organizations will need if data's been stolen, will possibly need to tell their customers that data's been stolen. If they provide a public service, like such as a utilities company, they will definitely need to tell their customers as well. And then also PR. I mean, there's a huge reputational risk with breaches. Usually around sort of 75% of the way through each incident, we will get a call from, or we'll get in a call with the legal counsel, marketing, PR from that company, and just hash out exactly what we're going to be saying to the public. But I do want to highlight that probably it's like the iceberg picture. It's like only the very tip of the iceberg is known to the public in terms of breaches that happen in the wild.
Yeah, and the speed of response and getting, and probably stepping outside of that sort of cybersecurity sphere of incident response, but you're right in that it's an important part of a crisis management overall, and feeding into each one of those. The quicker that information about an incident can be fed up into that crisis management team, can they make decisions? Yeah, you said mentioned legal teams, obviously hugely important as part of it, to understand legal implications and ICO reporting or data protection reporting. Crisis PR teams to be able to manage that brand and get the communication out accurately. I think successful breach responses, it's not just technical, it's how that the impact has been limited to their customers, to the brand, and communication being very, very much key.
Yeah, one of the orgs that I've dealt with quite a bit, sorry, one of the types of orgs that I've dealt with quite a bit are basically PR firms. So they will be literally scouring social media for any negative posts, positive posts, and they'll actually issue like shutdowns and stuff for these posts. It's actually quite aggressive, what these organizations do. And it's I've been part of some interesting conversations where you've got the CEO, you've got head of marketing, and then you've got like cyber on one side as well. And it's all about reputation. It's all about how customers see the business. And that is a so it is a big business decision, big thing that plays in the business.
Yeah, no, indeed. Okay, and I'm conscious of time, and I've got two more topics that I'd like to cover with you, Patrick. And one that crops up, quite regularly. And in fact, actually, I was at a cyber liability forum. I think I've got the right term there that I presented at, but really hosted by a legal team to talk around the insurance of cybersecurity insurance and where it plays, how effective it is, and everything that you kind of needed to know about it. But from your view, what is the role of cybersecurity insurance when it comes to incident response? I suppose that's from both the planning side and the execution.
I mean, cyber insurance is a funny one because it's different to car insurance in that, with car insurance, your car's insured. If you break down, or sorry, if you have a car crash, then they'll pay for the car. But with cyber insurance, not only will they, most likely or maybe pay for the cyber incident as well, but they'll actually provide a mechanic, an IR team to come in and assist. So it's slightly different to car insurance, and I would sort of see it not really as insurance, but more of just a response kind of package. I mean, there are some good things to cyber insurance in that it covers, financial risk, legal fees, regulatory fines, as I said, the IR team as well. So insurance is good in that way. And then access to pre-approved IR vendors as well is good. So, if you get IR through an insurer, then it's probably going to be a good IR team. Because they, that team will be used to a lot of breaches. You get a lot of business through IR insurance. They'll have legal experts that help the company help you abide by notification laws, such as to the ICO. And then some policies include PR and reputation management as well. So I mean, cyber insurance is a good thing. But as with all insurance, you just have to be careful to read the fine print. There's always if you don't, if you miss out on telling them one thing about the business, they could try and not pay out, basically. And as we do IR through both insurers, and we do it through non-insurers, as in direct. One thing we've noticed is that when you've got cyber insurance, the IR team is basically working for the insurer and not for the actual customer. So you just have to keep that in mind. So.
Yeah. All right, brilliant. And lastly, before we go to the Q&A, what I'd like to just cover is threat intelligence. We've talked a lot around the breach side of things, and we started talking very briefly around some of those threat actors that have been cropping up. But why, I suppose why is threat intelligence important, as part of incident response?
From my point of view as an IR person, and I've also delved a little bit into threat intelligence as well, they definitely go hand in hand. So they complement each other to the fullest. When you're doing an IR investigation and you come across a piece of malware or a particular threat actor, there's nothing better than to have the full bio of that threat actor, the full rundown of what that malware does, ready for you to just go away and know exactly what you're searching for. So enhancing the detection, basically enhancing your indicators of compromise, enhancing the context around them is absolutely amazing in IR, and that's what threat intelligence provides. Improved containment and eradication is also a factor as well. So intelligence-driven blocking of malicious infrastructure. So that's where the threat intelligence team will be able to tell you, right, this attack has got the group CLOP or Lockbit in it. We know that we've got this list of malicious infrastructure that those guys use. Just block this now, even though maybe you don't have proof yet that they are using that. Just block it now before and so it can actually save you a lot of containment and eradication time in the future. And then threat intelligence also really helps kind of in the boardroom or in the kind of the higher level discussions, because you can discuss attribution, which is attributing a threat actor to an attack, and assessing the bigger picture. So why are they attacking my organization? What is their motive? Which obviously also helps in ransomware negotiations. So.
Yeah. Well, John, one question that always springs up, or in my mind at least, when we're talking about attribution is, how effective is it? Or sorry, accurate is it? How are we approaching attribution? I mean, it's very easy when a ransom note or the data is being leaked on the leak site, that where they're claiming the incident. But attribution, how easy or how difficult is it? And we can have a whole other question and discussion on what the point of it is sometimes, other outside of what you've kind of outlined there, to help with the identification and the investigation. But how easy or how difficult is attribution?
These days with ransomware, a lot of ransomware incidents, majority of ransomware incidents, they kind of do the job for you, because they'll leak the data on the dark web, and they'll say, and they do that for a reason, because the second stage of the attack, which is the blackmail, we've got your data. But in the kind of smaller attacks and the APT kind of APT, more under the radar attacks, attribution's quite hard. And you really need to get all the indicators of compromise, all the different tools that they're using. You need to have access to good threat intelligence as well. So not, you need to from various different sources. I'm a big believer in sharing threat intelligence across the whole cybersphere. Not just keep it to yourself. I'm a full, a full open source kind of guy. Yeah, just being able to search it is really, really useful. So search, so if you found a piece of malware, search some of the indicators you found from it, across different, different vendors, different organizations. And yeah, so that makes attribution a little bit easier. But yeah, it's more difficult for the APT, the APT groups, I would say. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. All right. So we're 45 minutes in, and we try and keep these to 45 minutes usually. So I'm just going to jump onto the Q&A. And we've also got a few questions in. I think I will just flick through some of these. And the first question here for you, Patrick, because I think we answered a couple of them as we were going, but how do we know we are breached? What signs to look for?
Okay, so obviously, if everyone knew that, then they wouldn't need a SOC or they wouldn't need a antivirus or anything. but the we've got a I've got like a kind of a Bible or a set of thresholds which I always recommend our customers to call, invoke instant response to if they see them. So I'll just list through a few of them. When you see multiple hosts compromise, so if you see, antivirus alerts on multiple hosts, so not just the one, administrative account compromise. So if an administrative account is acting strange, a domain admin or something, for example, is acting strange, it's logging onto devices it shouldn't be. That's another one. Any suspicious activity on critical infrastructure should be classified as an incident. Exec staff, anything to do with exec staff, because obviously they have the high permissions, or that, that they can approve money and things like that. Ransomware is a given. So if you see files changing names, if you see the extensions changing, or if you see the contents of the files being unusable. And then finally, sensitive data exposure. So if piece of your data that should be internal is, for example, found on the dark web or you're notified of it, that it's out there, then that should raise cause for concern as well. So.
Yeah, brilliant. Another question, actually, there's kind of two tied together questions here. But one, Jaguar Land Rover, what could they have done better?
So obviously I'm not I wasn't in Jaguar Land Rover. I didn't obviously I we didn't I didn't do their forensics, but what I can say is, and this is what I've kind of heard from the grapevine, is that a lot of their infrastructure, or their service stations or their production line, absolutely everything was all connected through the same kind of the same domains and the same infrastructure. So once one bit got hit, it all got hit. So I would definitely have put segmentation in place, separate everything out, and also have a clear way of severing the connections with their suppliers as well, because I think some of their suppliers were scared about their networks being affected, which is why which is why this attack spread so wide.
Yeah, obviously hugely impactful breach. It's so impactful that I think it moved the UK instead of being positive 0.1% growth, actually was a bit of a decline by 0.1. There's another question that's touching into to politics here with a view on why TCS isn't paying for their mistakes rather than the UK taxpayer. Steve, I'm going to dodge that question as it's into politics. But yeah, with that kind of impact, you'd have to ask the question question why, because it's not just Jaguar Land Rover. And then I think we've got a couple more notes here, just again from Steve, that the brokers are separating cyber insurance from cyber crime insurance to cover some of those gaps that was mentioned. And the last one here is just again on cyber insurance, calling out that if they insist on providing the IR team, then they won't be familiar with your environment. So saying so, yes, need to read the small print as you said there, Patrick. And I think you're also right that they're operating on behalf of the cyber insurer. So the minute something is saying being able to actually join, they weren't following on the obligations that they've signed up to. Then all of a sudden that team's going to be pulled, which I think is a challenge, part of the challenge. And I know that you're mentioning that delivering IR for cyber insurance is one of the things that you and the team do, but also I think instances of where stepped in to cover some of the gaps that are being delivered when it comes to the cyber insurance IR teams. Okay, brilliant. Well, do you know what? We are 9 minutes to the hour. So thank you for everyone that has joined. Thank you very much for your questions. We are going to leave that there. I hope that we've walked through some of the challenges, some of the pitfalls when it comes to instant response preparedness, things to look at. I'm hoping from that first poll of confidence to be able to detect confidence to respond. We can start helping you move that more towards a position where we can be confident. And you know, some of those things that are important is definitely, you know, making sure that that preparedness exercise is being done. Your IR team, whether that's internal, external, a hybrid of the two, truly understand your environment, what's critical to you. Truly understand the people that are going to be involved, that are involved, the escalation paths, the processes, and that's, you know, working between those teams, obviously working internally to make sure that we're running those exercises. So it's not just the IT team, it's not just security that understand their roles and responsibilities. That extends out into the wider management, executive management, so they are prepared. In fact, actually, there was a breach only yesterday, day before, for a number of the London councils, and you know that was a crisis for them. And you can see that they've invoked their crisis management practices to be able to continue delivering services, even though their systems were down. So, you know, being critically important that is a business-wide challenge, problem, and answer. So, with that, I'm going to say thank you very much. Thank you to Patrick for joining today on the webinar, and hopefully we'll see you all again very soon. Thank you.
Cheers all. Thank you.